What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Are you a questioner, a wanderer, or even a bit of a snooper? If so, then you'll feel right at home in Knoxville. We've got miles of trails to wander in our urban wilderness, award-winning eateries to satisfy your culinary cravings, cultural sites to open your mind, and dog-friendly activities that'll have everyone wagging. Knoxville, calling the curious. Learn more at visitknoxville.com.
Today, an update from archaeological work on a theatre where William Shakespeare once performed.
The new revelations after a decade of research on Pictish Scotland.
And what snails can tell us about an archaeological site.
And welcome to the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. We'll be catching up with our very own Naomi Supall a little later, which I always look forward to. Plus, you're going to meet a couple of Time Team members too.
Yeah, all of that coming up. Now, the very first episode that we did of this podcast included learning about the Guildhall in King's Lynn, home to floorboards walked by William Shakespeare himself.
Yes, and that floor is the absolute star of the show as it was put in during the early 15th century and it's still all there to see. St George's Guildhall is not only the largest medieval guildhall in the country, it's also the oldest working theatre still in use. Now, we caught up with Tim Fitzhigham, who's running the major restoration and archaeology project at the Guildhall, last year while we were at Sutton Hoo. But a lot has happened since then, so I think it's about time we spoke to him again. Tim, it's great to see you.
Yeah, welcome back to the podcast, Tim. I understand your theatre's without a roof at the moment.
Yes. So, I mean, Helen was saying the floor's the star. And in some ways, of course, it is the star. It's amazing to have the floorboards that were walked on by William Shakespeare and his company alive in King's Lynn, which is amazing. However, we've now taken the roof off. And in taking the roof off, we've hit the largest 15th century Guildhall roof left in the UK. This is a roof that we've now dated through dendrochronology to even earlier than our fantastic floor.
It sounds fairly terrifying that you've taken the roof off. Do I understand that you've just taken the tiles off, the modern tiles off this amazing 1390s roof structure?
What we've done is we've taken everything off the roof structure that has been inserted in the 1900s. So that's left us with the 15th century material unfettered by 20th century additions. We're now able to look at it with only the 15th century material remaining. And it has given us some really exciting information, even in really obvious terms. Without the dendrochronology, you can see that there was a little turret on top of the Guildhall that no longer remains. It is genuinely really exciting what we're discovering currently.
And Tim, just remind me, because we touched on just how important this theatre is. And I mentioned, of course, the connection to William Shakespeare, who once appeared on that stage. Just go over again how we know that. How do we know that Shakespeare once stood there?
The honest answer is we don't really know very much about Shakespeare at all. And picking where Shakespeare was at any point in Shakespeare's life is almost impossible. What you can do is to piece together the very best information you have to provide the best likelihood of where Shakespeare is at any one point in his life. And what we've got in King's Lynn is a kind of unique picture of 1592-93. The London theatres are all shut for the plague. And we know that Shakespeare's company were paid to perform in the theatre in King's Lynn in 1592-93. Now then, two other documents become important because both of them list an event that they say happened in the theatre in Lynn, Norfolk, during a performance of The Murder of Friar Francis. And the event is that a lady was watching The Murder of Friar Francis with her new young second husband. And at the point Friar Francis gets murdered, she screams out, "I did it. I killed my husband." And this event inspired Shakespeare, we are told, to include that in Hamlet. We say he included it and heard about it because he was in King's Lynn when it happened. It's becoming a very likely picture that Shakespeare performed there. It's about adding together several tiny bits of evidence, just as you do with an archaeology site, and creating the likeliest outcome of those pieces of information.
Yeah, so you'd really have to be special pleading to say that he wasn't there in a way, wouldn't you?
Well, you need to find better evidence of where he was.
I would say it's looking very, very likely indeed then, isn't it? So the St. George's Guildhall, you're doing all this amazing work on it and you've been doing it for a while now. Where does the timeline take us from here then, Tim? Any idea when things will be open for people to come and have a look around and experience some of this amazing history for themselves?
Yes, well, Shakespeare House next door to the theatre is open right now. It's open Monday to Saturday, and people can come in there, and we've got a live feed of what's going on in the Guildhall space itself. In terms of the building, we're hoping to get hard hat tours going round the site as soon as it is safe to do so. We're about to start more archaeology, and hopefully we'll get that part of the site open for people to come and watch that dig as much as we possibly can when it's safe to do so. We are trying to rebuild the theatre at the same time as doing the archaeology in the theatre, and the same time as trying to rebuild it and make everybody safe, builders and also members of the public. So there's a lot going on, but the website is the best place. We put everything on there that people can, you know, come and do, and that's www.stgeorgesguildhall.com. It's so exciting to be renovating this theatre that's so very, very old. Hopefully now we're going to make it safe for the whole country going forward. It's so exciting.
The whole Shakespeare thing is absolutely extraordinary, but to realise that the theatre was already 200 years old by that point, and that when we go right back to the beginning of it, we're back in the reign of Richard II. You know, that's really kind of deep medieval times, isn't it?
You're right. It's just extraordinary to think that I can tell you who was on stage in the theatre in 1445. And there isn't anywhere else in the country that can do that. You know, I can tell you the names of the actors. It is pretty extraordinary. The archaeologists keep saying, "Well, this is completely unique. I haven't seen anything like this before." And it's just how many times on one site can an archaeologist say that? You know, it's just so exciting to be involved in. It's wonderful.
Oh, and I can tell how much you're enjoying it as well, Tim. I cannot wait to see it for myself when the opportunity presents itself. Thank you so much for coming on and giving us the update.
Yes, thank you so much, Tim. It's been lovely to see you.
Oh, it's lovely, lovely to see you. And I have to say, just as somebody who has adored Time Team since I was tiny and growing up and, you know, did archaeology at university, nobody saw me perhaps doing something quite so extraordinary in terms of just being involved in such an extraordinary archaeology project. But it's just it's wonderful to be back on Time Team. And it's so nice of you to take an interest. Thank you.
There's been a decade of archaeological research at the quiet rural settlement of Rhynie in Aberdeenshire that's revealed it was once home to a Pictish royal centre with connections stretching across Europe.
Yes, now a new book on the subject has brought these excavations to life and all of those years of work as well. It's been led by the Aberdeen Northern Picts project, which has reshaped the accepted history of early medieval Scotland.
The Picts are one of the most intriguing and most mysterious peoples of early medieval Britain, really. And so little has been known about them for so long. They've been so tantalising. So let's find out some more by speaking to Professor Gordon Noble from the University of Aberdeen. Hello, Gordon.
Hi, how are you all?
Very well, very intrigued and keen to learn more. I think you're going to have to talk to me like a complete dum-dum here, really, Gordon, because I know almost nothing about the Picts. So can you start by sort of setting the scene a little bit? Who are we talking about? Where are we talking about? When are we talking about?
No, don't worry. I'm embarrassed to say I grew up in Northeast Scotland and didn't know who the Picts were until my late teens. So it's an amazing subject that really hasn't had the publicity it deserves, I think. The Picts are first mentioned in Roman sources in the 3rd century as this troublesome group who are living north of the Roman frontier in what we would now call northeast Scotland. And then in the post-Roman period, they go on to become this powerful series of kingdoms, which are essentially ruling over an area that stretches north of modern-day Edinburgh, all the way up to the Northern Isles and across to the Western Isles. So a really large kingdom. And they go on until around about 900 AD, where we lose all reference to Pictish kings and kingdom. And it's replaced by a new kingdom called Alba, which is essentially the forerunner of modern day Scotland.
You've obviously found out such a lot from your work. How has our understanding of Pictish Scotland changed in these last 10 years?
We've got that limited historical record. But then on top of that, you've always had this limited archaeological record. Even when I was starting out doing work, you know, one of the big challenges, and indeed still a challenge, is where are the Pictish settlements? That was one of the really exciting things for me. You know, we know more about, probably still know more about the Neolithic of Scotland than we do about the Picts of Scotland in terms of the archaeological record. That was the big challenge. And that's what Northern Picts set out to do, is let's try and find some new sites. Let's try and identify elements of Pictish archaeology that we can begin to tell the story of this group who lived north of the frontier in this late Roman period and went on to become this, you know, really impressive kingdom in terms of its extent and its influence across northern Britain and beyond. So yeah, it's been really exciting to begin to find these sites and to tell us more about what we know about Pictish life.
Can we bring Rhynie into this a little bit as well? Because Helen was mentioning that was once home to this Pictish royal centre. What does that mean?
That was super exciting. So Rhynie was the first ever project that Northern Picts got involved in. And it was myself and Professor Megan Gondek, who's at Chester. And we decided, just as a sideline project, let's go to Rhynie, because there was all these symbol stones from Rhynie. And I like to think we had a big plan of, you know, let's go find a royal site of Pictland. We had no idea what we were going to find. Just piecing together all the clues about what we found, about the place name, which comes from this early Celtic word, re for king, seems to suggest that we're dealing with, you know, a kind of elite landscape of this kind of late Roman through to about 600, 700 AD in this particular landscape. And then over, 10 years, we excavated a site. They recorded this amazing enclosure complex in a crop mark on this kind of glacial knoll just to the south of the village. You could see all the kind of palisades and ditches and hints of buildings inside, but it had never been excavated. So 2011, we put a trench across those enclosures where a symbol stone called the Crossdane was found, which has a salmon carved on it and was known as a Pictish beast. It looks like, I don't know, like a cross between a dolphin and a horse or something. And so that still stands in the field today. And these enclosures were round about that monument. So we're like, you know, what on earth is this? This is an older prehistoric site. Is it a Pictish site? Only way to tell was to dig a trench. So we got scheduled monument consent, opened the trench. And within the first few days, we were beginning to find bits of imported glass coming from Western France. We were finding late Roman amphora that's coming from the Eastern Mediterranean. We phoned up our good friend Ewan Campbell, who's like the specialist on Western Britain and Irish imports. Just even describing the glass, he was like, oh, you've got some, trailed Gaulish glass coming from Western France. And that's only found in, you know, the kind of royal sites generally. And we were like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, I bet. So you must have thought you were somewhere quite remote, you know, northeast Scotland. It feels like it's cut off from Europe maybe a bit. But once you realise that, of course, you've got traffic across the North Sea, it's actually not so difficult. And so, gosh, that must have been a huge surprise to find all of that. I don't suppose Rhynie's ever been the same since.
No, it's absolutely amazing. A couple of years later, we looked at this huge hill fort that overlooks Rhynie called Tapanoth. And it's the second largest hill fort in northern Britain. But again, a site that had never been excavated. And it's even before we did some work there, we knew it was quite a remarkable place because there was lots of finds in our museum at the University of Aberdeen from Tappanoth that had late Roman material. And that was quite unusual because you don't tend to get a lot of late Roman material in northeast Scotland. So people have suggested, you know, there's something interesting going on here. But the kind of morphology of the fort is huge hill fort, 17 hectares in extent. You know, before we did our work, people could recognize there was maybe, you know, 100, 200 house platforms there. So a really extensive site. But people presumed it was Iron Age because most hill forts in Scotland are Iron Age or late Bronze Age. You know, it's quite high, 550 meters. So that made more sense in terms of the climate's nicer. This might be where you might live in the prehistoric context.
Yes, because we've been talking on our podcast recently about how much people actually lived in hill forts, given that they're often remote, high up, a long way away from water. They're often in the last places you'd want to choose to live unless you had to, or unless it conveyed enormously high status.
What amazes me about this whole thing is how much you have managed to uncover about the Picts in 10 years, but also how much there is still to learn, and there's so much that we still don't know. So I imagine for you then, Gordon, that the work is still going on. Where does your research go from here?
Oh, God, well, I don't know. I mean, it just Tappanoth kind of epitomizes just how little we knew. So as say, people presume it's prehistoric, but we dug it just before lockdown. And we got the first radiocarbon dates back during lockdown and it came back. The site was 3rd century AD to 6th or 7th century AD. So exactly contemporary with the kind of cross-stain site down in the lowlands there and all the Pictish sculpture. And that would just overnight, you know, you suddenly have a site that, well, turned out through LIDAR survey in Fort Grantry that it's actually got some like at least 800 house platforms within that fort. So absolutely ginormous, you know, almost kind of urban scale settlement dating to the Pictish period. And we had no idea it was there.
And yet it had been there all the time. So let me just confirm this. The hill fort building, even the ramparts, that classic Iron Age thing that we can all call to mind, all of that building was done at 3rd century or later AD.
Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
There is an Iron Age fort right on the summit, one of these vitrified forts. But the rest of it, the big, big fort, is all, you know, the late Roman through to, yeah, about 600 AD. So just, you know, absolute game changer overnight in terms of, you know, the results. And even we were surprised. We were just like, let's, you know, do a bit of work here just to provide a prehistoric context to the emergence of the Royal Centre down in the lowlands, not realizing that Tappanoth is probably actually what creates this Royal Centre down the lowlands in terms of having this huge population developing in that late Roman period, in the time in which, you know, you've got your last major Roman campaign that we know of, in terms of Severus's invasions around about 200 AD. And within a generation or two, this site at Tappanoth, and now a new one we're digging at East Lomond, which is quite similar, they're developing in this 3rd century just as this Roman presence is removed further south. So not only are we finding out more about the Pictish period, but we're also beginning to realise that, you know, that kind of late Roman reference to the Picts matches onto the chronology of some of these big sites in terms of they emerge in the 3rd century and they go through to about 600, 700 ADs, and that's when the overkingdom of Pictland is first mentioned. So they seem to be absolutely foundational, perhaps, to the development of the polity of the Picts and this kind of centralisation of society.
There's just so much new that to get your head around just that, I mean, when I say just that, what I suppose I mean is we haven't even touched on the symbol stones.
No, absolutely not. No.
But I feel like my head is bursting with new things that I've got to integrate into our story of early medieval Britain. First of all, we thought the Picts were impossible. Then I was under the impression that we knew a lot more now, but that the story was basically still the same. But that puts a complete spanner in the works now. We've got to now change our story to accommodate a whole new town, virtually, at Rhynie. So we'll have to get you on again to talk about symbol stones, because I think we're pretty close to running out of time, aren't we, Martin?
Yeah, I'm afraid to say we are. And you're right, we barely touched the sides of this. So I think we definitely, Gordon, need to follow up with you again at some point in the future. But thank you so, so much for coming on and explaining, you know, concisely 10 years of work. I mean, it's no mean feat. So thank you so, so much for doing that. And I will say this as well. If you're a Time Team member, by the way, you can get free access to the ebook on the research that we've been talking about. So if you just go to Patreon, patreon.com/timeteamofficial, I will also leave a link to the website that Gordon's involved in about Rhynie in the description of this podcast.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Are you a questioner, a wanderer, or even a bit of a snooper? If so, then you'll feel right at home in Knoxville. We've got miles of trails to wander in our urban wilderness, award-winning eateries to satisfy your culinary cravings, cultural sites to open your mind, and dog-friendly activities that'll have everyone wagging. Knoxville, calling the curious. Learn more at visitknoxville.com.
Occasionally on the Time Team podcast, we like to catch up with some of the Time Team regulars to find out what they're getting up to in their day jobs.
Naomi Sue Paul is Time Team's environmental archaeologist, and she's not long actually got a new job, which at the moment, as I understand it anyway, involves snails. Well, I say snails, it's, well, mollusks of all sorts, isn't it, Naomi?
That's right, Martin. So yeah, I can't believe it. I've been here just about 6 months now. The time has flown by. So once all the soil has been floated and the heavy residues have been picked, then it's time to unpick the plots. So that's all the stuff that floats up and out into my sieve. So pick out all the roots and get all that stuff out of the way, see what species we've got, and then take it from there. So I've had quite a few mixed assemblages with your grains and your charcoals. But right now, I am up to my eyes in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of teeny tiny mollusks. And they're all so beautifully, perfectly formed. It surprises me how they survive the excavation process, the flotation process, and are still there perfectly whole.
And you don't get mollusks from every site, do you? You need special soil conditions. So what kind of sites are you working on?
Mollusks are, are like bone. They like chalky soils, nothing too acidic, because they just don't survive. So I'm just trying to think. I mean, recently at Brancaster, that's an example, really good soils for bone preservation and mollusks and the many, many oyster shells that we found. I've never seen so many oyster shells in my entire life. But what's been interesting actually about some of the mollusks I've been looking at, it was on the cusp of sort of not too acidic, but not too alkaline either. There were a number of features that have been excavated on the site we've been working at, and we've had inhumations. And the human bone preservation hasn't been great, but I've definitely seen worse. And then I started to notice a pattern in some of the excavated blobs, which were sort of grave-shaped, if you like, but no bone had survived at all. But the mollusks that have been coming up are indicative of people being buried there. These mollusks, they're carrion feeders. They like to feed on sort of decaying matter, and that's not just vegetation. That's sort of people and animals as well. So even though we've not had the bone preserved in some places, we can extend sort of the cemetery and things that we're looking at by proxy, by looking at those mollusks and going, okay, there probably was somebody buried here, but we just don't have the bone evidence.
So that really shows the value of sampling in a grave, doesn't it? Even if you think this is completely empty, what on earth are we going to be able to get out of it? You can find something.
Absolutely. I think, I can't remember which site that we've done in the last 5 years, but we've had strange circular shapes or blobs where, you know, you've not been getting any finds, you've not been able to see any bone, it might have been quite a little bit clayey. So yeah, sample it and see what's in there. And we've done that before on some of our sites to see, for example, well, I've wanted to look for that kind of evidence that can tell us something about one thing, even though we haven't got the bone preserved, we've got something else that can tell us that there probably was something buried there.
And just to bring it back to the old the snails and the mollusks and all of that, what can finding that in a sample tell you about a site?
It can tell you a number of things. So for number one, it can tell you maybe that you've had an inhumation there, like I just said, but the bone hasn't survived itself. We can also look at the very immediate environment at the time when that grave was open and at the time that that person was buried. So you might get other environmental indicators that might have got sealed within that grave, a wee snapshot of a snapshot, if you like, before that was backfilled. So that might reflect something different to the rest of the environment, especially if you're looking at a site that may have been occupied over hundreds and hundreds of years.
I understand that with snails and things like, you get some snails that live in woodland and some that live in grassland and some that like the mixed environment of a garden or something. But what kind of mollusk is it that feeds on carrion?
There's several different species. The thing that's good about mollusks is that because there are so many different species and each one has quite a specific niche. So you might be able to group them into broad, this bunch like open woodland, this bunch like scrubland, et cetera, et cetera. But even within those that have common themes, they will each have something quite unique and specific about them. So it's great that you can group them all together. But then when you do get one or two, like right now, I've just come away from my desk. There's an assemblage with four or five species, there's a few hundred of each, but then I'm getting a few of another species which isn't as predominant, which must mean that within that, say, wet, moist environment that they're all flocking to, there must be something in that that's even more specific to attract another one. They are pretty cool. I do like them.
So how big are the samples that you're working with? Because, you know, you don't notice these things as you're doing ordinary archaeological excavation. Do you have to sample a whole feature in order to find enough mollusks to work on?
Well, I mean, for example, I mean, the site that I'm looking at the minute, we've got a range of features. So we've got ditches, we've got pits, but they're coming from post holes. So you've got samples coming from ditches or like your standard 40-litre samples. We've got lots of small post holes. They might only produce 3 litres of soil. They're all producing mollusks and other bits and pieces. It's just like a normal sampling strategy, really. If you've got a post hole, you might want to half section it and take that soil away in its entirety. If you've got a big ditch, you will sample maybe 40 litres from one context and one from another. And, you know, as you go down in time and down in depth, the sampling strategy doesn't necessarily change. It's, you have quite a standardized sampling strategy, but it's what comes out of it that makes all the difference, really.
You just wouldn't have thought there'd be so much to think about when it comes to a few snails and mollusks, would you?
I mean, you think about it. I mean, I'm sat here right now. As usual, my default position is to speak to you when I'm in my van. And I'm just sat looking. There's grasses. It's on an edge and on a roadside. All within that grass, you will have lots of little snails just moving along, doing what they like. I mean, in Lincolnshire, you've got crazy, very steep ditches at either side of the road. All along, the species moving all the time, tumbling down into those ditches, tumbling down into those cracks and crevices, and like on sites when we have post holes, they're attracted, you know, they go, oh, there's a cool looking shady spot near that post hole, and that's how they end up in there. So there's different ways as to how they do end up in there. But right now, yeah, there's stuff moving about all the time and you don't think about it. You don't really think about it. But that's how these things get trapped and then preserved. And then we come along and dig them and take samples. And that's how we find them. There's stuff moving around all the time and we don't realize in it, walking about, driving around in our daily life. Although you must have noticed that it is bug season. My windscreen is covered in bugs. So there's definitely an upturn at the minute in the different faunas that are flying about because of the temperature, because of the different plants that are out, et cetera, et cetera. We are living and breathing in our environment and that has never changed. And it's just lucky that we do get situations where these things are preserved and then we can look at them.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for stopping in the middle of your working day to tell us a bit about it. It always sounds so, so exciting what you can find out from the tiniest little pieces of evidence. So thank you very much for being with us, Naomi.
Not a problem. It's given me a little rest. My eyes have had a little rest from the microscope now anyway, so that's all good.
Now, just before we love you and leave you for another episode, I know we bang on a lot, don't we, about becoming a Time Team member on this podcast. And for good reason, the people who support us on Patreon are the people who will fund everything we do, from digs to research to the makings of the programmes and to this podcast as well. You have brought Time Team back and we really couldn't do it without you.
And with that in mind, we're always keen to hear what you like and what you think we could do differently. The hope being that if you enjoy what we're doing, then you'll tell a friend and help grow this amazing community.
So let's speak to a couple of Time Team members right now. Kathy is in France and Nicola's in Somerset. Hello to the both of you.
Hello.
Hi.
It's lovely to meet you. How long have you been members for?
So I signed up, I think, back in December 2022. I think it was fairly near the beginning of the campaign and all of that, because I caved quite quickly. The Time Team was trying to come back and so on. So I was quite eager to sign up for it.
I think I signed up probably 1 or 2 years ago, so quite recently. But I've been following you since I can't remember when.
Oh, that's really lovely to hear.
I was actually on maternity leave in 2019 and I was really bored at home with a tiny baby, really tired, didn't want to do anything apart from watch TV, and I looked on YouTube and I stumbled across Time Team and I could not believe it. So I binge watched every single episode.
That's amazing. How old is your little one?
He's 6 now.
Oh, a real Time Team baby.
Yeah.
A Time Team baby, whether he likes it or not. Yes. Kathy, what's your, because you've been a Time Team member, as you say, for a little while. What's your favourite bit about being a Time Team member then?
I think the thing that I like the most about the new format is that you still get the same sort of feeling that you used to do with the older TV series, is that when we were watching everyone on television, and obviously Tony Robinson, Sir Tony, was presenting, he was very much inviting us in, and he was kind of our intermediary, our little layman person who was going in and asking all the questions and inviting us through the screen. And I guess the fact that he was always talking to camera, and we felt like we were looking over people's shoulders, looking into the trenches, looking at the things they found. And I think the new format kind of keeps that going, in that we are part of the experience and we kind of, we're invested in it and we feel like we're engaging with the team. And I mean, it's right there in the name, you know, it's Time Team. It's always been, you know, what, not a one person gig. It's always been about multiple people taking part. And I think that's kind of what gets people hooked on it, I think, and always has been.
That's really interesting to hear. I think that we can do more of that now. We can take people's ideas into account, and the team is much bigger now because it includes all the members. You're all part of Time Team. That's really interesting to hear.
Nicola, what have you been enjoying recently then that we've been up to?
I particularly enjoyed watching the Sutton Hoo bucket being excavated. That was fascinating. And the little patch repair, when you found out that that was part of it, was amazing. I was so excited when that happened.
That's really nice to hear as well, because we've tried to bring more science into Time Team. It's one of the things that has changed in the years we had off. It's now so much easier to get mobile analysis. And now we've got Naomi as well. We can do so much more on site, whereas before it was all sending things off to a lab. And then that didn't happen in the 3 days. And it all became really difficult logistically. So we've got the freedom to be able to do that. So it's really nice to hear you say that you're appreciate that. This is lovely, isn't it, Martin? It's like having a focus group. It's lovely to hear, because you're experts in the watching. So it's like interviewing an entirely new kind of expert. It's just great.
What about you then, Kathy? What have you been enjoying that we've been up to recently?
I think the one that really touched me the most was the Princey burial and the DNA results afterwards. finding out that very personal connection. And I know it's been said on the show many times that, you know, it's not about the princes and the kings and the big dates of history, but the people, the individuals and the people who are living in these farms or villas or whatever. And you know, really kind of touching on those lives, you know, through the centuries is absolutely fascinating.
I think that the DNA evidence has almost made us a bit more, it's made us a bit more historical in the stories that we can tell, in that history allows you to, the documentary history allows you to see individuals, which archaeology historically hasn't done, but it doesn't let you kind of meet them. You just hear about them. Whereas when you excavate a grave and then you get the DNA analysis, you've got the person there. You've actually met them in a sense, even though they're not alive anymore. And then the DNA gives you almost a name. It gives you an identity. I suppose that's what the word I'm looking for. So I completely agree with you that that takes you to another level, being able to have that along with the more traditional archaeological side of things. And people do love to get involved with a story that feels like, I mean, each person is another person just like us. You're watching a human come back to life almost out of the earth. I love being involved with things like that too. So it's really good to hear that you like to watch it.
Kathy and Nicola, we sort of have gathered you here today as, I suppose, representatives of all the Time Team members to say thank you, really, because I know I say it a lot, but it's so true. We really couldn't do all the archaeology that we do. We couldn't make the programs we make. We couldn't do the podcast that we do without your help and the help of all the Time Team members. What would be your message to someone? And Nicola, let me start with you. What would be your message to somebody who is maybe thinking about supporting us, thinking of becoming a Time Team member, is maybe on the fence about whether it's a good idea or not?
I would just say absolutely do it, because if they enjoy the show and the work that you do is important to them, then supporting it like that is a really good way of making sure that it continues. And it's also a great way to make sure that archaeology, awareness of archaeology is there and is getting better and bigger because of Time Team. I believe it is anyway. It definitely sparked my aspirations and enthusiasm for archaeology, and I want that to be the same for lots of other people.
And how about you, Kathy?
I guess I would say that as well as supporting and encouraging and helping Time Team to continue to exist, it's also for the person subscribing or supporting, it's your little gateway into this world, and it's your connection that you're building there. And, you know, we get all the extra little bits of content and the extra little, you know, the links and the conversations and so on that go on Patreon. It's taking a little bit a step further into the world of Time Team. And I think we, you know, if anyone really has appreciated watching Time Team, I think, you know, being a part of it in that way is just that extra bit special.
It's so great to hear that. You know, the thing that I'm thinking of is how much Mick Aston would have loved to have met you and to have heard about how Patreon has been able to do this, has been able to link us with people who can support us and people who can find out how great it is to learn more about the past and about archaeology specifically. Because he was always such a big supporter of community archaeology and of people's interest. He always just wanted to get people interested and part of the team. I'm just so glad we can do it now, but it's such a pity that he's not been able to see it.
Absolutely. Would have loved to have met him. He always, you know, he's just shone through the camera. Such a character.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, both Nicola and Kathy. Thank you so much for being with us on the podcast. It's been a treat to meet you. It's always lovely to meet patrons, whether they come and visit us at a site or through the podcast. I think we should have more of you on the podcast. It's really nice. So thank you very much for giving up your time.
Thank you so much for having us.
And that really is it from me and Helen on this episode. A question and answer episode next week, when you'll find out why ditches are so important to archaeologists and whether climate change could destroy our buried ancient history.
Yes, now join us next week wherever you get your podcasts, or ad-free for Time Team members on Patreon.
Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you soon.
Bye.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Are you a questioner, a wanderer, or even a bit of a snooper? If so, then you'll feel right at home in Knoxville. We've got miles of trails to wander in our urban wilderness, award-winning eateries to satisfy your culinary cravings, cultural sites to open your mind, and dog-friendly activities that'll have everyone wagging. Knoxville, calling the curious. Learn more at visitknoxville.com.